Okay, so today you're going to hear from me about gas and galaxies. You're not going to hear about feedback because I don't know much about feedback, but I'm very interested to learn more about it, and I've been learning a lot so far today as well. So I'm going to talk to you today about some properties of atomic and molecular gas in galaxies, and this is work that involves quite a few people. Let me highlight both current and former students from Illinois, Raisha, who's currently finishing up with me at present, and then Ki Jong Yim, who got her degree 2 years ago, who's now at Groningen. Also, longtime collaborators include Alberto Bellotto, Adam Leroy, Annie Hughes, and Eric Roslovsky, and other people that I don't have time to mention today. So I'm going to talk about a few topics which I think are interesting to think about when it comes to gas and galaxies. And again, I'm not going to connect them explicitly to feedback, but I'm interested in thinking about how they might be related to some of the issues that are coming up this week. First, I'll just review some recent results, not mine, on statistics of gas content in galaxies, which I think provides a larger view than what we can do with individual objects. I'll talk about some individual studies of galaxies, both to look at the Faison distribution of gas and also the vertical distribution. And then I'll comment on a few aspects of star formation relations, which I think are worth keeping in mind. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because I think that that whole topic of the star formation relation is actually been well covered recently by Adam Leroy in a paper last year, which I encourage you all to read. So some of the questions that I think are motivating this presentation are basically how complicated and multifaceted the ISM is in galaxies. We can't just look at one particular type of gas. We have to recognize that there are several molecular gas. Is the coldest and densest phase, at least in our vicinity, is the one that's most related to star formation. And that's very unlike atomic gas. Atomic gas is multiphase, it's cold and it's warm under a wide range of conditions. And because of that multiphase nature, if you just look at a galaxy that's face on, the parts of the atomic gas that are actually not involved in star formation can be heavily overrepresented when we look just in terms of area. Okay, because the densest gas tends to occupy the smallest volume. So we need to be careful about how we weight our points when we display our data points. Are we weighting by mass or by volume? And how does that affect the conclusions that we draw? That's not to belittle spatially resolved studies. I think they're very important. That's mostly what I do. But we always have to be aware of the sampling and detection biases that we're subject to. Okay, so for instance, there may be dense clouds in our galaxies which we tend not to notice because they occupy such a small area. Conversely, there could be very diffuse gas that occupies a lot of area but we're not sensitive to because of our surface brightness sensitivity. But if we actually integrate it over an entire galaxy, it could actually occupy or constitute a very large fraction of the mass. So with spatially resolved studies, there are unique biases and sensitivity issues that integrated measurements don't suffer. And finally, an important point, I think, is that when we look at trying to predict star formation recipes or laws, they can only really be formulated once we identify and isolate the denser cold gas component. So we need to understand how that component is developing. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the statistics of gas content in galaxies. This is a subject that's mainly been the domain of single-dish radio telescope studies, and perhaps the most comprehensive work has been done with the GAS project, Galaxy Arecibo STSS survey. That's basically using Arecibo to get the H1 for a well-selected sample of galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. What I'm showing here is the H1 to stellar mass ratio plotted against the stellar mass. And unfortunately, our field is full of these plots where quantities appear on both axes, so this must be taken with some caution. But it's an interesting way to display things because it tells us whether or not the H1 tracks the stellar mass as the stellar mass increases. And as you can see, it doesn't. You can see that there is a negative slope here. So as the stellar mass increases, the H1 mass doesn't necessarily decrease, but it doesn't keep up. And you'll notice that there are also a lot of upper limits here. And these upper limits are distributed throughout this range. And so it turns out that stellar mass may not be the most fruitful way to look at this. This is instead stellar mass surface density. And you see the same trend, but now you see the upper limits are over here. So that's suggesting that, in fact, the surface density is more important for whatever is causing the H1 to disappear. It could be that you're now talking about bulge-dominated galaxies that have, for some reason, lost their cold gas component. So you can do similar things with molecular gas as well. Of course, with molecular gas, you're using CO as a tracer, and so you have to worry about how well you can trust the CO. But with the ERAM survey cold gas, which sort of partners with the gas project, you can see that similar trends are also seen. Now, here it's important to recognize that the blue circles are different from the red in the sense that the blue points only have the CO detections, and the red points actually include the non-detections as upper limit values. So if you just focus on the detections, what you'll notice is that the ratio of molecular mass to stellar mass is actually fairly constant across the star-forming sequence. So as the stellar mass increases, the molecular gas mass actually keeps up, except as you get to this regime of high stellar surface density, where suddenly there are a whole bunch of non-detections. Okay, and once again, it seems like the stellar surface density is the key variable here. And it suggests that there's some kind of a bimodality or some other difference that's happening. There's still a lot of high surface density galaxies with lots of molecular gas. As you can see here, it's still pretty flat. And yet there's this population that is lacking molecular gas. And I think that's important to bear in mind because what I'm going to show you are lots of CO maps, and it's easy to lose sight of the fact that we only have CO maps for the galaxies that we detect CO in. Okay, so what I'm going to show you in terms of CO maps is not necessarily representative of galaxies the way that these other surveys are. So that's, I think, an important conclusion. The detection rate of H2 is a strong function of stellar surface density. So how does the atomic and molecular gas compare? Well, there's a large scatter if you try to compare the two masses. In general, galaxies are H1 dominated. So if you look at sort of the mean trend, and it's very scattered, as you can see, the molecular gas is about a third of the atomic gas. Okay? And that's based not just on the single dish measurements, but also on mapping by Leroy et al. Find sort of a similar range of values and a similar level of scatter. On the other hand, there is a dependence on Hubble type, something that had actually been noticed even in the 80s by Young and Hnisek. Basically, if you look at the molecular to atomic ratio, it does seem to increase with early types and decrease with late types. So there is a trend with Hubble type. More recent study by Baselli et al. Finds a similar trend, except here with the blue points, they've ignored the H1 deficient objects, which they associate with clusters, galaxy clusters. But if you were to include them, you would really see the same trend. Basically, the molecular gas dominates the atomic gas in this set of early type galaxies, whereas as you go to later types, the atomic gas starts to dominate. Okay, so that's sort of what we've learned about the global statistics of molecular and atomic gas. You might think that with the high surface density galaxies having more molecular gas, they would also have more star formation. That doesn't seem to be necessarily the case, according to this recent study by Santong et al. Here you see the sort of classic Schmidt law, molecular gas Schmidt law plot, where you see star formation rate versus molecular surface density. And the blue points represent relatively low surface density. The red points are high surface density. You'll notice that many of the red points are located sort of offset and to the bottom of this plot, which means that the rate at which they're turning their molecular gas into stars is quite a bit slower than in the other types of galaxies. So there does seem to be a difference in how different surface densities correspond to star formation, which might not have been obvious in the nearby galaxy studies because they simply didn't have that many of these early types. Mu is a sort of a stellar surface density, which is generally averaged over some optical radius, I think. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. So, yeah, this is a stellar surface density. Okay, so that's sort of an interesting result. And some of the ideas which I think have been suggested are that perhaps somehow the high surface density galaxies have a big bulge. Maybe that stabilizes the disk in terms of its gravitational stability. Or maybe it results in more molecular gas in a diffuse phase. That's certainly unclear, and I think there's still a lot more to be done with targeted high-resolution follow-up. So let me now talk a little bit about the resolve studies, and that's related to what we see in terms of surface density distribution. And again, this subject has a long history. Back in the 80s, Tacconi and Young pointed out how the molecular gas has a very similar radial profile to the stars, whereas the atomic gas had a very flat distribution. And we still see that with more recent studies, including Adam Leroy's big paper in 2008, where the stellar scale length was found to correlate with the CO scale length in their sample of galaxies. So it's clear that the molecular gas mimics the stars, and that's not surprising, perhaps, except that the atomic gas doesn't do that. And we know, as we've seen, that the atomic gas actually dominates in most galaxies. The other thing that spatially resolved observations have revealed are central concentrations of CO in some galaxies. This is a paper from the Bima Song project some years ago, showing that in many galaxies, there's actually an increase in the CO surface density right near the center that almost mimics the stellar bulge. Kind of surprising, because the bulge of a galaxy is not thought to be related to the interstellar medium, and yet you still see a similar upturn. It's not universal, and as I was talking to Karen about, there may be issues of the X factor in those regions as well. Nonetheless, it's been suggested that what happens in many cases is that you get central concentrations that are driven by bar torques. So barred galaxies appear to have higher central concentrations. If you look at diffraction of gas within some radius, it increases as the bar strength increases. And if you look at the central surface density of galaxies as a function of Sirsak index, you also see that the galaxies with sort of more pseudo-bulge-like profiles actually have centrally concentrated molecular gas. And they also seem to show a preference for barred galaxies as well. So there could be effects, sort of second-order effects, on the radial profile that arise from bars. Comparing the molecular and atomic gas, as we've noted, the molecular gas follows the stars. The atomic gas is fairly flat. So as you'd expect, the ratio of the two actually correlates very well with stellar surface density. It's actually a remarkably good correlation, which I've always found puzzling. This is the ratio of molecular to atomic gas versus stellar surface density. It's not a correlation that arises naturally from anything I can think of, because the stellar surface density is dominated by the older stars. One suggestion that we've been fond of is that this is related to the hydrostatic pressure, the midplane pressure, which can be written as a quantity that involves the stellar surface density. Unfortunately, when you do that, the correlation is not nearly as good. And so this is something which I think is still a little bit puzzling, and I'm going to return to a few times as well. But one explanation is that the hydrostatic pressure somehow increases the formation rate, or the conditions, improves the conditions for forming molecular gas through basically allowing the gas to be compressed by stellar gravity. But I think that this comparison still leaves me a little bit puzzled. So one thing that we've done recently is start to look at some of these correlations in a wider variety of galaxies. So most galaxies that have typically been studied in CO are galaxies that are all very massive and metal-rich. With Karma Sting, a project that I've been doing with Alberto Bellotto and several others, we've been looking at galaxies that have a range of stellar masses. And the CO contours here are in blue. I don't know how well you can see them. But we have now CO maps for some 20 galaxies, as well as H1 maps for a large fraction of those as well. So for about 18 galaxies, we can do kind of a spatially matched comparison of CO, H1, and other tracers, like, for instance, 3.6 micron Spitzer data, which traces the stellar mass. So one of the things that we did early on was just to plot a few independent quantities. It's quite useful as observers to plot independent quantities. So you can see where the uncertainties come in. This is molecular surface density assuming a constant CO to H2 conversion factor on the y-axis. This is H1 surface density using the optically thin approximation on the x-axis. And the points here are color-coded by metallicity. So as many people know, Mark and his collaborators came up with a fairly comprehensive theory for how the molecular to atomic transition occurs. It's based on metallicity as a key factor. And we were looking to see whether we could actually test that idea. And it turns out that we do see a trend here in the typical H1 column density with metallicity. So the metal poor galaxies are in blue, the metal rich galaxies are in red, and there is a color gradient, as you can see on the left side of this plot. So that suggests that indeed what's happening is that for the more metal rich galaxies, you're transitioning to molecular gas at a somewhat lower H1 column density because of the higher metallicity, the higher dust content, and the shielding from UV radiation. In an attempt to actually apply the model, we basically used a prescription for the H1 saturation column from McKee and Krumholz 2010. Here, the points have been referenced to that prediction. You'll notice that they actually represent a fairly good upper limit, but there are many points that scatter to the left. And one possible interpretation of that is that the beam filling factor is such that there's a filling factor adjustment which needs to be made to convert from the large-scale measurements that we make to the individual cloud column densities that are predicted by the model. So it's possible that difference is mainly driven by the beam filling, and that's something which Ray Scher is going to explore as he continues his work. A different result, which I also found very intriguing, was that if we color code based on stellar surface density, we get this. And so these are really the same points, but now we, instead of coloring by metallicity, we color by the stellar surface density. And you'll notice that the color gradient is now vertical instead of horizontal. So the H2 surface density is primarily related to the stellar surface density. Not too surprising, given the other results that I've presented so far today, but nonetheless quite intriguing, because it does suggest that somehow the total molecular gas supply is regulated, so to speak, by the stellar disk. Now, I think we should remember this is really should be kept in quotes. These are only the CO-detected galaxies, so this is by no means universal. But it's interesting nonetheless, because it's not the way you might expect, right? You might expect that, of course, more CO, you should have more star formation, because there's a natural causal relationship between molecular clouds and star formation. But you might expect the opposite between CO and stars, because as you turn more CO into stars, you should have less CO and you should have more stars. So we don't see that. So for whatever reason, perhaps there is some kind of resupply of the molecular gas, either from the stars themselves or from some kind of accretion process. Perhaps it's not so much the supply, but the consumption of molecular gas is somehow regulated in a way that wasn't apparent in the standard version of the Kennecott-Schmidt law, but there's certainly room for some changes to that. So for whatever reason, there is this intriguing relationship. And this also suggests that one reason why the H2 to H1 ratio correlates so well with surface density, with stellar surface density, is that H2 itself correlates with stellar surface density, and H1 anti-correlates because it correlates with metallicity. It anti-correlates with metallicity, and so H2 over H1 might correlate even better with stellar surface density. Now, that's for spiral galaxies. There doesn't seem to be a similar effect in the LMC. As you can see, the stars are here and the molecular clouds are elsewhere. So this is by no means a universal rule. I don't know how much time I have left. 5 minutes, okay. Okay, I'll try to go a little bit more quickly here. So we've also been interested in the vertical distribution for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's thought that the gas volume density is actually more important than the surface density for star formation. And so if you look at this equation by Krumholtz et al. In 2012, they express the star formation law in terms of volume density. It sort of makes sense that it should be so. Also, if you wanted to actually test some of these models for hydrostatic pressure controlling the molecular to atomic ratio, you actually need to know things about the vertical distribution of gas and stars, things like the stellar scale height, or even the density of stars and dark matter versus the midplane density of gas. Okay. Well, why don't we have more measurements of this? Well, it turns out it's really hard. Okay, so the typical resolution of H1 maps is something like 15 arc seconds. So for nearby galaxies, for even nearby edge-on galaxies, that's something like 750 parsecs. So we have attempted to do some work in this area using the best data we could get hold of. This is VLA data for four edge-on galaxies, and this is BIM and KARMA data of CO at a resolution of about 3 arc seconds, so 150 parsecs. But as you'll see, we've still only not really fully resolving the scale heights of the CO and H1. We're getting scale heights, inferred scale heights, which are still smaller than our beams. And so there's still some uncertainty in how robust these results are. And I think that it's clear that the H1 disk is flaring, but variations in the CO disk, I think, are a little bit harder to be sure about. So we can also see variations in the stellar scale height as well, because using the CO kinematics, we can actually get a pretty good handle on the inclination of the galaxy. And we can use that to model how the scale height of the disk is changing. And it does seem to increase with radius, which is a little bit contrary to the expectation of a constant scale height. But of course, that's not to say that we're necessarily able to resolve different components of the disk. And so it could be that there are just different components that contribute at different radii. So under the simple assumption that we can just look at H1, H2, and stars as the three basic components, we can try to apply the standard prescriptions for calculating pressure to some of these data. So this is the molecular to atomic ratio versus pressure for four edge-on galaxies using the Blitzen-Rostowski formulation for pressure. And you can see that they match pretty well the trend from that paper, p to the 0.9. On the other hand, if we apply the Ostrak-Riddell prescription, we see that there's considerably more scatter and considerably less correlation. And this is a little bit surprising because this is a more realistic approach that includes several effects that are not considered in the Blitzen-Rostowski formula. And so, again, it seems that the more we look at the pressure, the less convinced we are of what it's telling us. Okay. I'd like to end with a few brief remarks on star formation relations, a few things which I feel I've seen a bit too much of and I want to caution people about. First of all, the obvious effect of comparing luminosities against each other is that things tend to scatter along correlation lines whenever there are d squared factors. Even if we look at fluxes, there's a tendency for us to see richness effects just because when we have more surface density, we tend to have more of everything. I think a very nice approach, which I wish people would do more often, is to look at normalized quantities like Leroy et al. Did when they compared the star formation efficiency or timescale with the gas surface density. Basically, this plot shows that there is no Kennecke-Schmidt law when you consider all of the gas. There's no particular relationship with gas surface density. There's also even problems with using just a molecular gas, and that is revealed by this work by Blanc et al. There's enormous scatter in these measurements. Some of the scatter is related to the things that Karen talked about in the previous talk. A lot of it is also related to the very different sensitivity limits of the different observations. And so the way people treat their upper limits has a huge effect on the types of Schmidt law relations they come up with. So that's something that I think people also need to be more aware of. Okay, so let me quickly summarize what I think are some useful points to think about in terms of the distribution of gas in galaxies. Molecular gas, at least based on CO, and again, there's certainly some considerable uncertainty in how well we can rely on this, seems to be strongly coupled to stellar surface density. Okay, so very distinct from the atomic gas. On the other hand, it seems that the H2 disk is much thinner than the stellar disk. We see that in our galaxy, certainly, and we see that in the thin dust lanes we see on edge-on spirals. So any coupling between stars and CO has to be somewhat indirect, it seems, maybe related to disk dynamics. And I think that the midplane gas pressure is still a strong contender for being a fundamental process or fundamental quantity underlying this coupling. But we're still not in a situation where we can actually find a stronger correlation with pressure than with the stellar surface density alone. And part of that's because the pressure involves not just stellar surface density, but a very strong dependence on gas surface density that doesn't correlate very well with the H2 to H1 ratio. So I do wonder whether maybe we should focus more on this quantity here, which might be a little more sensitive to the stellar surface density, which is basically the vertical oscillation frequency related to the tumor AQ parameter. Anyway, I'll stop there, and I welcome your questions and comments.
I'll just comment first that in this expression, really, it shouldn't be sigma gas on the outside. It should only be the diffuse phase. You don't want to, you only want to include the volume filling, not the molecular, when you're looking at the, what you have in square brackets is the gravity, and the other term should be the volume filling, but not the total gas.
Oh, okay, so this it's legitimate to include the total gas more.
Yeah, and the gravity, but not the.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So, and I think that that would give you, you know, then you're basically, since the H1 is the volume filling part, I think that would give you a correlation much more like with just the stars.
Okay, interesting.
A question. If you look in the regions of galaxies where there aren't many molecules that are H1 dominated, is the H1 surface density there well correlated with the stellar surface density?
Generally not, because the H1 surface density has a much longer scale length than the stars. So the disks extend much further out, if that's what you're
saying. Yeah, no, I understand that, but is it better correlated than in the inner parts? Because if you're saying the H2 correlates with the stars and the H1 doesn't, that's not very surprising in the regimes where most of the gas is molecular.
I think in general that's the case, that H1 correlates poorly with the stars, although I could probably show you a plot or something in the next couple of days. We can talk more about that.
I mean, there certainly are examples of these dwarf galaxies where there's a small stellar component and an H1 that goes out like 5 or 6 times further. So clearly the scale length is enormous compared to the stars.
I understand, but are they correlated? I'm not saying are they one-to-one correlated, right? But are they correlated? Are they both going down, or is it monotonic at least, the relation?
The H1's often pretty flat.
Yeah. In fact, when people look at rotation curves, they often talk about a conspiracy between the H1 and the dark matter, not between the H1 and the stars, though. So I think that's the gist of what people are finding.
Could I see one of the former slides again? This one, yeah.
This one, yes.
Yeah. Is there now a correlation or is there not a correlation? This yellow line, is that significant or is it not?
So I think part of the point of this study was to show that the way people had traditionally done the correlation, and I'm guilty of this myself, is using the ordinary least squares bisector, which you can see here is the orange line here. And the problem was that we were basically ignoring the fact that we had a large number of non-detections, which could potentially be in this regime here. So what they've done in this study, and I think Adam Leroy has also done this in his most recent work, is to try to use Monte Carlo methods to simulate how the points should be distributed in this non-detection region, and thereby get a slope which actually is much closer to unity. About 0.8 is what they just derived here. But I don't want to get into the arguments about the slope because they seem to be enormously involved.
Tony, if I can just ask about this, isn't it also often true that particularly the CO data can be single dish, single point measurements, and so converting it into a surface density is a little problematic? You often assume, say, the optical size or the optical size with a factor.
Yeah. What I think the resolved sub-kiloparsec or sub-galactic studies show is that the scatter is really enormous. And when people integrate over galaxies, the scatter seems to decrease considerably. And that's in part why people like to show the Kennicott 1989 or 1998 plot, is because basically when you do global averages, you get a pretty tight correlation. But all of the subgalactic studies seem to show similar levels of scatter.
I'll ask another question. I remember Robert Brown was arguing that there's a lot of H1 missing from the galaxies because it's cold and self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. Is that still something that we have to, you didn't mention any of that. Is that something you worry about?
A little bit, sure. The impact of optically thick H1 is likely to be limited on an area basis because it has such a small area coverage. But in terms of the total H1 content, there could be quite a large correction. So depending on how you were to, I mean, if you do like an area-weighted star formation correlation, then maybe not a big deal. But if you now look at integrated properties and you're actually trying to, you know, determine what's the total H1 mass in these very massive optically thick galaxies, then yeah, the correlation, the correction could be a factor of a few.
One last chance for questions before coffee. Okay, then let's thank Tony again. And we'll come back at 10 to 4.